The reading this morning is from John. But he had to go through Samaria. So he came to a Samaritan city called Sychar, near the plot of ground that Jacob had given to his son Joseph. Jacob's well was there, and Jesus, tired out by his journey, was sitting by the well. It was about noon. A Samaritan woman came to draw water, and Jesus said to her, "Give me a drink." His disciples had gone to the city to buy food. The Samaritan woman said to him, "How is it that you, a Jew, ask a drink of me, a woman of Samaria?" Jews do not share things in common with Samaritans. Jesus answered her, "If you knew the gift of God and who it is that is saying to you, 'Give me a drink,' you would have asked him, and he would have given you living water." The word of God for the people of God.
Water symbolizes many things.
Water cleanses.
It restores.
Water gives life.
It is peaceful.
It is essential.
Water is powerful.
Where there is water, hope dwells.
With God, there is always something in the water.
I've heard the choir sing the offertory anthem that you did a moment ago. I've heard you sing that before, but I think I've only heard it sung with the organ. Have you done that with the whole orchestra? But you have. Okay, well, I've been asleep at the wheel, I guess. But I know that whenever you do things like that, there's a lot of work that goes into getting music for the full orchestra. And that, you know, I think those of us who sit here and listen to it all the time think, oh, easy peasy, right? There's a lot of background work that goes into that. And the other thing I've noticed today is members of our orchestra helping the students who are here and talking with them. And Sherry, I've just kind of watched that going on and just want to thank you again for all the work that you put in and another beautiful morning of music today. Also, an apology to you. Last Sunday in this series, Something in the Water, I failed to mention to you that we had these prayer cards as kind of a daily way of remembering our baptism, cards that you can put in your shower, and they're waterproof. And I sent an email out, but you might not have gotten the email. If you want to pick one up, and I've actually misplaced mine this morning, they're in little baggies out on the table so that you can have the suction cup that sticks to your shower wall and a hook to put the card on. And if you take your shower in the morning, there's a prayer to pray. Or flip it over for an evening prayer if you take your shower in the evening. In fact, that'll just be a fun conversation piece as you go out today. Just look for somebody you don't know and say, "When do you like to shower, in the morning or in the evening?" And get to know the people who are around you in worship today. But do pick one up, one per household if you would, so we make sure we have enough for everybody. Not one per shower, one per household. Hope you'll get one on the way out the door today. So we continue our series today. When we started this on Ash Wednesday, we looked at a story about wells in the book of Genesis, Isaac digging wells. Well, today we look at another well story where Jesus engages in one of the longest dialogues in the gospel. Jesus engaged a woman at a well in Samaria. And what I want to do is I just want to go through this story and point out parts along the way in this story that are places of key meaning. And throughout the story, we'll also think about some good reflection questions that go with these places of key meaning. So I hope you'll get your pen or pencil out. This will really be helpful if you're in one of the small groups meeting during Lent, to kind of take into your reflection with your group when they get together. So I invite you to take out your outline that has basically the outline of this story on it. And you'll see at the top of your outline the very first verse you heard read in the story a moment ago, and there's no place to begin like the beginning, right? So the start of this story, now he had to go through Samaria. Now, Samaria, whenever you see that word in the Bible, you can almost count on the fact that what follows is going to have something to do with racial tension. Many of us know that there was tension between Jews and Samaritans, but where did that come from? This map gives us a little bit of an idea, if you can see it well enough. in the center is a whole region known as Samaria. It was between Galilee to the north and Judea to the south, where Jerusalem is located. Now, in the days of the Old Testament, Samaria wasn't a whole region, it was an individual city. And we find out what happened in 2 Kings chapter 17. A foreign nation known as the Assyrians conquered Samaria, and they transported its citizens to other conquered nations. And they brought people from those conquered nations to live in Samaria. Now, why did they do that? It was a way of keeping a people suppressed. Put people in community who speak different languages, they're going to have a hard time banding together and revolting. That's why the Assyrians did this. But what happened over the centuries is the foreigners who lived in Samaria came to believe in the Hebrew God, but they were not Jewish by faith or by race. They were Jewish by faith, not by race. So people who were racial Jews began to look down on Samaritans as being less than pure. Now, what did this animosity look like in Jesus' day? It started to flare up over lots of issues, like where is the true temple located? And because Samaritans didn't feel welcomed at the temple in Jerusalem, well, they built their own temple on Mount Gerizim in Samaria. And they started making a case for why that is the true temple. I mean, it makes sense that you would do that, doesn't it? In North Carolina, just a little distance outside of my hometown, Winston-Salem, up in the mountains is a country club called Roaring Gap Country Club, built years ago by members of the R.J. Reynolds family and other elite of Winston-Salem. It provided a cool getaway in the summertime. Well, at some point, a lawyer in Winston-Salem applied to be a member of Roaring Gap, and he got turned down. He wasn't well-to-do enough. So what did he do? He went 2 miles down the road and built his own country club called the Old Bow Country Club. Bow, named for the Georgia mascot Bulldog at the time when he was a law student. It makes sense. If you've been scorned in one place, you just go build your own. Like the old saying goes, if you can't join them, build your own, right? That's what the Samaritans did. So that word Samaria just packs a lot in it right away. But look at the other part of that sentence. Jesus had to go through Samaria. Now, why did he have to go through there? Let's go back to the map for a minute. If you were a Jewish person living in Galilee and you were going to go to Jerusalem, you typically would not go through Samaria because you avoid those people. What you do is you go south of the Sea of Galilee, and then you go over to the Jordan River through a region known as Perea, and you go south until you get to the Judean border, and then you go up to Jerusalem. In other words, I don't want to face these people, so I'm going to go around. Have you ever done anything like that? You ever gone to the grocery store, gone onto a certain island? Oh, I do not want to see that person. And you're going to go over to the frozen foods, you know, take the long way around the grocery store so that, now I can tell that's never happened to any of you before. That's what Jewish people would do. So if Jesus had to go the direct route, that must mean he was in a hurry, right? He had to get there pretty quickly. But what we learn at the end of the story is he stayed in Samaria 2 more days, 2 days that he wasn't even planning on. So there wasn't an urgency for him to get to. What does it mean that he had to go through? It's telling us something about the theological importance of Jesus' ministry. His ministry was going to be for everyone, not a select few who want to build their own religious country club. It's going to be for everyone. In other words, the time has come to quit going around and go through. Did you read in the paper the other day the Indy Star story in the sports section about John Wooden? When he was the basketball coach at the Indiana State Teachers College, which of course is now Indiana State University. In 1946, he recruited the first black player on that team. That was just months after Jackie Robinson put on a Dodger uniform. After that barrier was broken, right here in Indiana, John Wooden and Clarence Walker were breaking a big barrier. And that Indy Star article did a great job of talking about what Clarence Walker went through that first year he played for the team. Now, why would John Wooden and Clarence Walker do such a thing? Because it was time to quit going around, and it was time to go through. Sometimes God says, I want you to quit avoiding. I want you to go through. I didn't have this as a reflection question in your outline, but it makes a mighty good one, a really good reflection question. Lord, are you calling me to go through any place today? Are you calling me to go through something and quit avoiding it? So that's the first sentence in this story. But then we come to a couple of important notations. And the notations start to appear as Jesus engages a woman at this well in Samaria, and they enter into a conversation. And as soon as this is being told, the writer of the gospel puts a little statement in parentheses, sort of a notation, like, I don't want you to miss this point. And the first one's in verse 8. His disciples had gone into town to buy food. Now, why does it tell us that? Because Jesus' encounter with this woman would have gone down radically different had the disciples been around. You see, this would have been an uncomfortable place for the disciples. A woman from Samaria, the lowest of their social caste system. Talk about a person with no rights, a person Jesus should not even waste his time with. If Jesus would have tried to have conversation with her the entire time, she would have looked over his shoulder to see the disciples shaking their head in derision, like, I can't believe we're even here right now. Rolling their eyes, tapping their feet impatiently, like, when is this going to be over? I mean, do you think it really took 12 people to go buy food? Jesus was just getting them out of the way. Oh, let me ask you, have you ever known any disciples of Jesus who get in the way of people meeting Jesus? You ever known any followers of Jesus who actually make it harder for people to get to Jesus? So if you want a good reflection question here, I don't recommend it for everybody, to be honest with you. I only recommend it to the courageous of you, okay? If you're feeling bold, if you're feeling really, really bold, write this reflection question down. Lord, am I getting in your way? Am I getting in your way? Boy, I tell you what, if you pray that just a couple of times a week, it'll change your life. Well, here's the second notation. So Jesus engages this woman in a conversation. He says, will you give me something to drink? And she looks surprised. She says, what, you, a Jewish man, asking me, a Samaritan woman, for a drink of water? And then here's the second notation. For Jews do not associate with Samaritans. Now, by this point in the story, that's not a surprise, is it? But some Bibles have a little notation on that verse, and they say there's actually another way that that verse can be associated. Here's the other translation. Jews do not use dishes Samaritans have used. Well, that's a little different, isn't it? I mean, that puts into picture form what the animosity looks like. Here's the difference. Let's say I said to you, back in the 1950s, there was racial division in America. And what's the difference when I show you a picture? That's a big difference, isn't it? That there were white water fountains and colored water fountains. But you know what's funny about that picture? Look at the pipe that's underneath them. It's the same water. We all drink the same water. We all need the same source of life, whether you're black or white or Asian or Indian, no matter who you are. You have a basic human need, and is in God's eyes, there's no difference. We're all the same. So here's another good reflection question. And this one is particularly helpful whenever you get crossways with somebody, whenever you're tempted to just focus on differences. This question asks, how can I relate to others' humanity? How can I relate to others' humanity? When it's tempted to focus on the differences, when it's tempting to start to get judgmental about why a person acts the way she does, why a person says the things he does, to say, wait a minute, I bet we're both after the same thing. I bet we both want peace. I bet we both love our families the same. What are the same things that we're after? Well, let's focus now on the woman. The woman Jesus is in dialogue with. They have this conversation about a drink of water, and then Jesus uses a word with double meaning. He said, if you knew the one who was asking you right now, you would be asking him for a drink, and guess what he would give you? Living water. Now, there was a double meaning, spiritual and practical. But at this point in the conversation, the woman focuses on the practical. And look at what she says. We begin to learn something about this woman. Sir, give me this water so that I won't get thirsty and have to keep coming here to draw water. What are we learning about this woman? Well, we're learning in that touch of sarcasm in the statement that this woman's life consisted of fetching water every day, probably several times a day. No matter what goes on in the rest of her day, she can count on one fact every morning when she gets out of bed: I'm going to have to go get water again today. I'm going to have to take these same old buckets to that same old well and bring back water to the household. Why? Because that was a woman's job. That was what a woman did. And could it be that a woman who was simply living up to the expectations of a woman in her society was beginning to allow her to feel less of a person? Could it be? Could it be that a woman in our society today could try to live up to what society says is how a woman should behave and start to lose her humanity in the process? I'm sorry, I thought there were some women in here today. I thought that might get a little response or an amen from one or two. Could it be? Could it be that a woman says, I'm grateful for my right to sit at the table with men, but I do understand that if I never say anything, they're going to think I don't have anything to say. And if I say too much, they're going to think I'm domineering. I get it that I can work with men and do the same job, but I better not expect the same pay. Oh, I get it that I need to look a certain way, and the way I should look is probably going to reflect on my character, maybe more than the man who's next to me. Is it possible, not just for women, but even men, to try to live up to what society says is what you're supposed to do with your life, and along the way, begin to lose something of your identity? Oh, she says, what I would give so that I don't have to keep living my life like this. So the conversation changes, and Jesus says to the woman, so go bring your husband. And the woman says, well, I don't have a husband. And look at what Jesus says in response to that. The fact is, you've had five husbands, and the man you now have is not your husband. In Jewish law, you were permitted just three marriages in your lifetime. If by the time the third one didn't work, okay, that's tough luck if you're going to be a good Jewish person. Jesus wasn't saying this to judge her, though. He wasn't condemning her. He was showing that he understood her. Here is a woman who is managing a lot emotionally. Here is a woman who, because of this fact, might not be accepted in her own Samaritan village. Remember, she's coming in the heat of the day to draw water, and she is alone. That's not what women typically did. They went to draw water together as a community, and they did it at two times a day, in the morning and in the evening when it was cooler. Why is she at this well by herself at the hottest part of the day? Because her own company might be the only place where she feels welcome. And here is this man who is showing respect to her, who's showing that she's understood. And now the conversation turns in a spiritual direction. And the direction is about the right way to worship. But Jesus, he's not going to have a debate with her. He wants her to know that I'm offering you today living water. Understand that that was not some spiritual euphemism. It was a very practical word. It meant spring water. That's what Jesus said. I will give you spring water. Now remember, this is a day and time. People couldn't go to the kitchen and turn a faucet. You couldn't get water that way. You had two sources for water: fresh spring water or river water, or water that was stored in a cistern. And if it's in a cistern, that means it's been sitting. That means it's still. Lots of stuff grows in still water, you know? If somebody offers spring water, that is a lot more appealing. But of course, Jesus is talking not just about practical things. He's talking about spiritual things. What is the point when he says, I am a source of living water? He is saying, I am a source who can take things in your life that are dead and stale and beginning to grow boring and monotonous and routine. And I can bring some life to that. I can give life some new energy and some new hope and some new meaning. And now this woman is starting to get it. She says, oh, I want to believe that. I want to believe that. I really do. I want to believe that one day the Messiah is going to come. And he's going to make sense of all the stuff in life that keeps us from being the full children of God that we can be. And Jesus says to her, I'm that one. I'm that one. Jesus uses the expression that the kind of worship that God really looks for in life is worship in spirit and truth. You know, I find a lot of times we turn to the Bible for answers. Give me an answer to my problem. But you know, sometimes I think the Bible wants to give us questions to live with. Questions to enter into dialogue with God so that just like this woman, we have our own dialogue with God and kind of hear what is God saying to us. So one last great question is, what does it mean to me to worship in spirit and truth? What does it mean to me to worship in spirit and truth? Somehow connected with that statement in this story for this woman is this idea that Jesus can be a source of transformation. A very interesting fact in this story. This is the first time in the Gospel of John Jesus reveals his identity as the Messiah. Now think about this for a moment. The first person he says, I am the Messiah to, is not one of his own disciples. It's not any of the religious elite. It is to a person that his own community of faith would have said should be the last person to know. That's the first person. Could it be that this woman perhaps was most receptive to Jesus as a source of transformation? The other day, my daughter gave me a book to read by a young woman named Mo Isom. And I read it very quickly this weekend. It's about a young woman who's a very gifted writer. And the title of the book is based on an experience in her life. It's called Wreck My Life. She grew up in Georgia. Very athletic, very gifted, very smart. Grew up in a home of faith, but religion for her as a little girl was about something that you did, you know, just a routine that you go through. She always struggled with what was the reason behind the routine. So her faith was not a major part of her life. She found as she was growing up in high school, very gifted physically as an athlete, going to beauty pageants, that she got attention for the way that she looked. So you can imagine the source of tension that created in her life. Pretty soon she began to realize the one thing that I have control over to get what I need is to control the way my body looks. So naturally she developed a serious eating disorder. By the time she was a freshman in college playing soccer for LSU, when she finally admitted to her mother how bad her eating disorder had gotten, forcing herself to vomit 12, 15 times a day, that her mother got her into counseling, got her on a new path of healing, and then that was the time that her father took his life. A daddy she knew was broken, but a daddy she looked up to for a sense of value and self-worth. Well, this kind of caused an even further downward spiral. She started partying hard. She was having many, many relationships with guys. She was growing miserable by the minute. She was driving back home from LSU to Georgia for a Thanksgiving break her junior year, and she got into a terrible automobile accident. The car had flipped over. She was unconscious. And in that unconscious state, she had an experience with God, an experience where she just felt like God saying, I just want you to know, I love you, Mo. I love you. And this car wreck looks just like your life. You were on a collision course. You were bound to wreck sometime. But I want to put you back together. And that experience was so vivid to her when she woke up in the hospital. She knew instantly, something about my life has changed. Something is different. She began to reorient her life in a direction of a relationship with Jesus Christ, saying, I really want to make that first. I feel a freedom. I just feel like a new person. I feel some hope for my life. I just didn't have hope before. When she went back to school her senior year, she was beginning to enter this relationship with Jesus, beginning to receive direction like, God, what do you want for me? And she felt, after listening to a sermon about fasting, she didn't even know what fasting was, where you give up things like people do in the season of Lent. She goes back to LSU, a senior, good-looking girl, and she felt God say to her, I want you to fast from guys. No dating. I want you to go 1 year without kissing a boy. She said she realized that was the hardest for her because she had become addicted to guys. She needed to have a guy on her arm to feel good about herself. This radically changed her life. She writes all of this in that book, Wreck My Life. She tells how at the end of 1 year, the first guy she dated is now her husband. And they just celebrated the birth of their first child. She's a new person. She's a changed person. She's much, much like the woman at the well. She had been living her life trying to live up to what the expectations were for a young girl in her world, trying to do what she believed would give her the value and the attention and just the feeling that I am somebody. All that the world said, this is what you've got to do. And she realized that's a sham. She needed somebody to set her free from that, and it took a wreck to discover it. But here's the best part. She's given her life since then to telling her story, trying to give hope to other people. That's what she wants to do, is to give hope. She's become quite the hit on social media. She blogs regularly, and tons of people, especially teenage girls, follow her. The woman from Samaria goes back to her village. She tells everybody about this person she met and said, could this really be the one? They went and talked to him and said, would you stay with us 2 more days? And after 2 more days, they went back to the woman and they said, you know what? We believe in him too. Not any longer because of what you said, but because of what we've come to know. After Jesus was dead and resurrected and ascended into heaven, His followers would experience tremendous persecution, and they had to get out of Jerusalem. Where is the first place the followers of Jesus Christ went for safe cover? They went to Samaria. Why? Because a woman told her neighbors about what Jesus had done for her. Does your faith ever get dead like water in a cistern? Does your faith ever get to a place where it just feels stale and old and lifeless? Just ask God, what kind of transformation, God, do you want to give me? And then if you want to keep it alive, tell other people your story.